The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Shell, and on today's episode, we're going to take a look at and listen to bug music. A little later on, we'll check in with Bug Girl to talk about how some of the sounds that insects make come from some very unexpected places. But first, let's talk with someone who hears songs underneath those sounds. My first guest today is musician and philosopher David Rothenberg. David is a professor of philosophy and music at the New Jersey Institute of Technology and the author of Why Birds Sing. His book, Thousand Mile Song, about making music with whales, is currently being developed into a feature documentary called Whale Stock. His latest book, Bug Music, came out this year, along with a CD of the same name, featuring music made out of encounters with the entomological world. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
So that, sir, is a lot of books about animal music. How did you get interested in all this?
I would say it began when I think in high school, I was searching for a way to combine my interests in the environment and nature with music and exploring different directions in music. And I grew up in Connecticut, and I heard about this guy, Paul Winter, who lived up the road. And he was playing with wolves and eagles and whale songs. And so when I was at a young, impressionable age, I ran across Paul Winter doing similar things. And that's when I first thought about the possibility. But I really didn't do anything with it for about 20 years after that. I kind of thought it was done, like enough was done in this area. But then I realized hardly anything was done, and hardly anybody was taking this connection between animal communication and sounds and music very seriously. It seems something that a lot of people realized. You know, people think bird songs are beautiful. We call them songs in most languages, most human languages all over the world. But beyond just saying, oh, that's a song, people hadn't really taken it all that seriously in a musical way and trying to figure out what that would mean to take animal sounds seriously in a musical way. Then I realized there was a lot more to be done here, connecting art and science, music and biology, poetry, work of naturalists who are in between all these areas, that there was this whole direction that needed to be made more explicit. And that's how I ended up writing Why Birds Sing. And then after that, thinking I had to do another book on whales and then another on insects.
Where you hear music, a lot of other people might just hear noise. So why do you think that is?
Most people like bird songs and they think they're musical, even though they're very different from human music. So birds are making all kinds of sounds, even the songs people love, like nightingales, mockingbirds. They have not much to do with human music in the traditional sense, but people have recognized them as being a kind of music. So we don't have this real problem with thinking other animals are doing musical things or performing in this way. And even insect sounds that sound very far away from normal senses of human music, as a sound of crickets on a summer evening, the sounds of katydids going ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch back and forth. People recognize this as something beautiful and they like it. We like it. And that the next step means to think, well, what's actually musical about these sounds that we like? And that's where I've found that there's a lot to be learned by really joining in, by trying to play one's own human music together with the music of other animals. And that, I find, is where the sense of what counts as music can be expanded when we try and blend our own ideas with those of the aesthetics of other species.
Well, you're not the first person to find music in the sounds of insects, though. Your book covers a lot of literary references to the topic throughout history, so maybe you could give us some examples.
Just yesterday, I went to a concert here in Berlin, where I'm living for a year, of amazing string quartet concert, the Artemis String Quartet, and they played I think it was Bartok's Fifth String Quartet. And this piece I really didn't know, but it's full of insect sounds. And I had written in my book that Bartok was one composer who very specifically was influenced by insect sounds. And I write about a piano piece called Out of Doors he wrote in the 1920s. But this string quartet was even more insect-like. So I asked the violinist afterwards, like, do you know anything about that piece? You know, where do you think those sounds come from? You know, do you know Bartok specifically said he used the sounds of insects in his music? And she said, what? I never heard that. But it makes sense. You know, now that you mention it, that could explain a lot. So I think these things are out there, but they're not so well known. One of the reasons Bartok did this, not only was he interested in all kinds of stuff, folk music and everything from his environment and his time and history in the first half of the 20th century, but in the 1890s, there was a Hungarian scientist who transcribed in musical notation the songs of insects of Hungary, you know, which is kind of an odd thing to do because they don't look that much like music. You have a single note repeating over and over again and a little, little like trying to represent something like a something like that in musical notation. He was trying to do that. So for a composer like Bartok, who loved weird things in music, you know, the boundaries and the stretching of musical notation needed to encompass even the basic Hungarian folk songs. You know, he must have smiled when he read that and said, oh, let's put some insect sounds in here. And I felt I could really hear this in this piece. You know, that's a well-known piece of 20th century classical music, but I don't think people think of it as connecting to insects so specifically as I believe the composer did. It's true, as you mentioned earlier, once you start listening to these sounds and deciding they're interesting, you hear music in places that previously you might not have heard it. But I also talk a lot in this book that this should be of no surprise to anyone who likes the sounds of electric guitars and distortion and any of the parts of popular music today, which is full of all kinds of weird noises. And I thought when I made this CD that goes with the book called Bug Music as well, I thought I was making something that I thought was kind of strange, but in fact, it's not. It's actually a lot like pop music. It's a lot like dubstep, strange, whooshing electronic sounds. And I thought that the CD would be received as something kind of strange and odd. And actually, it's somehow much more popular than all the other CDs I've done. And I thought were more like more normal music. This strange bug stuff is actually like, oh, cool, that's fine. That fits in. It's much more accessible than I thought, in a way, which was a nice surprise.
There's also a gentleman that you wrote about who's currently raising crickets specifically for their song, a Mr. Fung. What's his story?
He's a Swedish librarian, basically, who spent years in China. And he used to run the Chinese library in Stockholm, Library of Asian Books. And he just decided to put all these species of crickets together and make music with them, following up on the very well-established Chinese tradition of keeping crickets to listen to them, to hear their songs, as well as to have them fight each other in competitions. So he talked to me about this dichotomy between these same crickets are for sale in markets in Shanghai and Beijing, either for fighting or for listening to. You decide what you want to do with your crickets. Are they warriors or musicians? And different people buy the same crickets and do different things with them. You know, they decide, it's like taking your pet, you know, what are you going to do with your pet? Turn him into a racing dog or have him lie around the house and feed him? The same things with crickets in China. And I was also amazed to find, you know, literally thousands of poems written about singing insects in Asian languages, particularly Chinese, Japanese, also some in ancient Greek, this obsession with the sound of singing crickets and cicadas and katydids. And I was just surprised how much attention these creatures had had over the thousands of years. That's definitely more of an Asian phenomenon, really loving the sounds of insects as a kind of emotional and spiritual and romantic thing. Then I saw a few like popular, like equivalents of like Chinese type Hollywood movies. And very often insects would appear in these romantic scenes, you know, in a kind of cheesy way that you might see doves and, you know, and birds in movies we're used to. The insects would suddenly appear, butterflies, and crickets would be singing in sudden romantic moments in these Chinese films. So obviously you have a whole part of the world where insects are closer to people's heart.
There's a number of theories as to why exactly that is. What makes bug sounds so special, right?
I tend to push an idea in the book that I don't really try and prove, just saying like, this is music, these sounds were going on when human music was invented. They're so many millions of years older than anything we're doing, that when we started making music, we already were hearing insect sounds all around us. So maybe we got interested in regular rhythms from hearing the regular rhythms of tree crickets going all kind of synchronizing together. Maybe we heard that and got interested in having a regular beat. There's certainly a lot more regular rhythms in insect music than in bird music. And I think that it's very likely that when humans started making music, they were taking in all the sounds around them and trying to respond to them and work with them and be connected to them. And it's really no surprise. I think one idea that I put forward in all these three books that sometimes people resist is the idea that, that there's much more music in animal communication than there is anything like language. That music as a way of communicating is far more common in nature than language, where specific words mean specific things and are put together in specific syntax with specific meaning. Like when we put sentences together, that's more uniquely human than music. You know, a pattern with rules and order and beauty and form and shape is performed by all kinds of creatures over and over and over again. So it can't be putting forth a message in the way that people sometimes think communication has to be. They say that, say, a bird song is easy to explain. It means, here I am, I'm a male bird, and I'm looking for someone to mate with, and I'm looking to defend my territory against all you other guys. So here I am, let me say it again. You know, the function of bird song is defending territories and attracting mates. End of story. So that's what you learn in biology class, and it's true. But there's one important thing missing from that explanation. It says nothing about the shape and form of the song. How come it's so different? How come a chickadee just has to sing doo doo, and a mockingbird has to go pew pew pew, all these things over and over and over again to do something with the same function? The difference is in the aesthetics of each species. Each species has a kind of sound that it's evolved to like and make and respond to. And that's much more of a musical idea than a message idea. The message in the mockingbird song is the same as the chickadee song. But why does the mockingbird sing for an hour at a time, for 2 hours at a time, and the chickadee just sings two notes? Because each species makes a different kind of music, but the message is the same. So you can't, you know, it's wrong to say the mockingbird is saying a lot more information in its song. It's much more like a piece of music where there isn't really information in it. You know, all those notes, and yet you can't really say what each note means. It's very hard to turn it into a message, like a language that can be deciphered. You know, music is a very strange thing. It's very remarkable how much of it there is in human history, in human culture. How did this even evolve? Why are we making all this noise, putting all these sounds together when there is no complicated message that is put across? Okay, you might say, oh, no message, but isn't it so emotional? Doesn't it communicate emotions in a way no other human activity can? And the answer is sure, yes, and the same thing with birds, and probably the same thing with insects. These songs are communicating emotionally, even to these animals that have much simpler brains than we have. The emotional content, at least in birds, is probably still there. Insects, I don't know. I mean, their brains work differently. But the other aspect of music, where it's like mathematics and rules and form put together, insects are much more like these little machines that respond, kind of the way sometimes science is accused of making all animals sound like little machines with no volition, no sense of individuality or identity or subjectivity. Sometimes animals sound like that in science, but anyone who works with birds or other more evolved animals knows that they are individuals who do things you don't expect. But insects might be more like little machines that are part of some giant whole, where an order is formed where each part doesn't know what's going on. The order emerges, like, you know, the ants all together building the ant colony. Each one doesn't know that much. Each katydid who's singing, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch, that's what they're doing. And they kind of respond to each other, but in a way that can be kind of quantified mathematically. But you end up with this beautiful series of overlapping rhythms that mark a late summer night. You know, it's not random. It's not arbitrary. It's kind of beautiful and rhythmic and, you know, hard to replicate and hard to, you can't exactly pinpoint what patterns are going on there. But that's kind of how rhythm arises. That's how music appears out of sounds that seem disconnected. They fit together because each one is doing their own part. And when you start listening to all these insect sounds and appreciating them, you start to hear different kinds of sounds as being musical. You kind of go through the same trajectory that led humans to take an instrument with a clear tone like a guitar and plug it into boxes that make it noisy, that add fuzz, that add effects to it. It's the same things that something like a cicada is doing by making a sound that starts as a single tone, like, and then it gets kind of rhythmic and noisy, and then dissolves. So even a noisy, thrum that appears out of nowhere, made by one very loud insect, is actually a kind of music. It's organized and has this shape and form. I forget where you're sitting exactly, whether you're hearing singing insects at this time of year or not, but you probably know what I'm talking about.
You're dealing with a lot of topics in this book that there are no answers for at this point. Even something as simple as you are very fascinated by the cicada. And specifically, the cicada that only appears on years with prime numbers. Tell us about that.
Yes, I mean, how could one not be fascinated by these several species of cicada that come out only once every 17 years, or in a related species, once every 13 years? You know, this is the year they came out around New York. But every year they come out somewhere. There's about 19 broods of them. Brood 2 came out in New York this year. Next year, brood 3 will be in eastern Iowa. After that, brood 4 in East Texas. So if you're a cicada file, you can find them every year somewhere. Take a trip. But it's just a remarkable thing that they have a life cycle like this. It's almost impossible to explain. You can't explain why they're doing it. You can't explain how it evolved. Pretty much everything written about these species is a matter of speculation. And when scientists decided to name them in Latin, they named the genus Magicicada, because they knew there was something magical about this. Magicicada septendecim, the 17-year cicada, the 17-year magic cicada. You know, it's pretty amazing. And then you have the fact that it turns out they have this very complicated mating ritual with sound that nobody imagined an insect could have. There's three series of different songs the males sing to convince the females that they're the ones to mate with. And also the females make a sound as well, which nobody thought was going on in the cicada world. They flick their wings. The males have these organs called timbals that they're kind of drum. They're vibrating. It's like the surface of a drum. And so this very specialized way of making sounds, the males making the main sound and the females making this clicking sound. And together they have to go through these several steps of dialogue before mating happens. And when these things come out, there are millions of them in the trees. And then a few weeks later, they're gone. And then the eggs are laid and then they hatch and the little nymphs crawl underground and sit there alive for 17 years, slowly eating, sucking on fluid from the roots of trees, waiting to come out 17 years later. How can they possibly know when it's the right time to come out? How can a little insect figure this out? It's completely crazy. And there is no good answer. I can say various answers, but none of them is particularly proven.
Why do they sing in the first place? Is it only related to mating?
That's a good philosophical question. You know, is it only related to mating? Why do birds sing? You know, is it only related to mating? You could say, look, the males are singing and this attracts the females and there you go. But that's turning the phenomenon into a function, like I mentioned earlier. Another way to look at it is, if you study what's going on in the brain of a bird while he's singing, you can see the dopamine being released. You can therefore see that the bird is addicted to singing. He loves it. So at the end of Why Birds Sing, I say birds sing because they have to. They must. It's of their very essence. They are singing beings. That's what they do. You know, scientists don't like that. What are you, some sort of like, you know, what kind of answer is that? That's totally unscientific. You're trying to say that, you know, singing is what birds do. Come on, they do it for a reason. Everything in nature happens for a reason. I said, you know, not really. You know, it's happening, but there's no reason, say, for a bird to have evolved a song that goes on and on for hours. What a waste of energy. What a waste of practical evolutionary survival of the fittest kind of stuff. They'll say, no, the bird with the longest song is the fittest. It shows how strong and tough it is, has good genes. And I said, yeah, good genes for what? For singing. What the bird does is sing. You know, the female birds like the birds that sing well. So singing is of the very essence of being the bird. And this is a philosophical difference that, you know, it's taken me a while to convince scientists that what I'm saying is actually serious and they should listen to me. And I'm saying, look, you know, you people studying bird song, we've learned a lot about how animals learn from studying bird song, but you can't tell me what makes one nightingale song better than another. And yet all the female nightingales know. So how come they know something we don't know? Couldn't we figure it out? And they say, no, it's too subjective. I said, it is not any more subjective than anything else. You just have to take it more seriously. And so recently, I convinced some scientists to take my ideas seriously. And just this summer, I finished my first, you know, long, technical, very difficult scientific paper on the musicality of birdsong that's full of all kinds of technical stuff and doesn't read like this book you've read, but reads like something full of statistics and, you know, it's like hard scientific stuff, and we'll see when it comes out in a few months whether the scientific community thinks there's anything to this.
But there was some research done about that was designed to force insects out of their rhythm.
Yeah, so the story about typewriters and katydids is more of an anecdote in a paper by Richard Alexander that people keep quoting, that he was just typing and he noticed that katydids go ch-ch-ch. And he noticed if he typed something like that, if he did, if he added some notes, the katydids would compete with him and try and outdo him. And then another one would do something similar up to like 7 or 8, and they couldn't do any more. And so that's repeated in almost all insect song books. And maybe there's, you know, and Alexander's still around. He's like 90 years old. It's nice to find out how many of these great insect scientists are still around when I asked for permissions to use their quotes and pictures. You can find them. They're like online somewhere and they write back right away.
So that's research per se then.
Well, no, I'd say it's like, were they trying to force? They were trying to show that katydids do respond to similar sounds. You can interact with them. And so I would say, yes, it is research, but in what sense is it interesting research? Musically, it's very interesting. You could take some katydids and really play some music with them. Otherwise, to make it scientific research, you'd say, well, how much can I bend the song of a katydid, and to what end? What difference does it make? Then you have to design an experiment to mess with the sound and see where you can go with this. And I don't think anyone has done that with a ch-ch-ch-type katydid story, but maybe they have. It's very possible. But
well, is there anybody researching bug music in a rigorous scientific way?
Well, there's hundreds of people studying, the sounds of insects in different ways, and there's a lot of the research in cricket songs and katydids is how they actually do they synchronize with each other and how do they do it? What kind of rules are necessary to predict their behavior? And Michael Greenfield has written a lot about, you know, these algorithms that lead how tree crickets can synchronize without knowing very much. And it's the same algorithm that allows fireflies to synchronize, which Stephen Strogatz has written about in a book called Sync, kind of popular book of his research, that synchronization can happen in nature without anybody being in charge, you know, which is a famous idea throughout physics. The idea, this is all they have to do. You know, you have like, each cricket's making a sound like that. And the only thing they have to know is they hear a lot of other crickets singing and they listen to the sound that's closest to them and they move their sound a tiny bit closer to it. And then the rhythms gradually come into sync. That's all they have to know. And they've done experiments demonstrating how that works, how that crickets do. You can use this algorithm. And I made, on the website that goes with this book, which is bugmusicbook.com, I talk about, I wasn't sure this really would work. So I asked a friend of mine who's a programmer, can you make a little app that does this? Let's see if it works. And so he did this little programming thing. And so you can test it out. You can download that and run it and demonstrate how this mathematics does lead to cricket sounds to synchronize. You might say, well, why would anybody want to study that? What's the point? Well, the point is how rhythm can be generated by simple organisms that aren't thinking that much, which you could extrapolate, how dumb people can make techno music or something like that. You don't need to know much. You could go in that direction. Or you could say, is it just interesting how rhythm evolves in nature at a very early point? Insects are millions of years old. Rhythm has evolved because mathematics predicts it can happen. I think that's pretty cool. But sometimes you talk to certain audiences don't like hearing this. What do you mean it's mathematics? You're making it all cold and mechanical. And say, no, you're not. You're showing how very simple rules can lead to complex beauty. It's pretty interesting.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be back with more bug music after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm joined by musician and philosopher David Rothenberg. David has performed and recorded with Jan Bang, Scanner, Glenn Velez, Carl Berger, and Peter Gabriel, and he's also the author of a number of books about non-human music. He's here today to talk about, specifically, bug music. Now, you mentioned earlier on that that some people are actually using bug sounds to make music. Can you talk about that?
Well, on the one hand, you have people directly using insect sounds and making music out of it. On the other hand, you have whole genres of music that already sound like bug sounds because they're made electronically out of synthesizers. And, synthesizers at some points try to imitate real historical human instruments, but by their very nature, they kind of imitate, they make sort of electronic sounds that are, made out of sine waves and mathematics. And when you read science papers on cricket sounds, it sounds the same as music software manuals to talk about how sound is made. Same language is used. And this is one connection that I was really surprised to find. And I've gone and talked to some, electronic music software designers, like, your products are great at imitating these insects. Do you know that? You could work together with scientists and really quantify how these sounds are put together. And they were kind of surprised at this connection. And that's one of the kinds of work I'm doing now, is bringing scientists and musicians together to get them to help each other. But back to the sound quality, I really think there's, electronic music is mainstream now. It's in every genre of music. But we like these artificial humming, buzzing, noisy sounds. We use them in our music, and there's nothing unusual about that. We take them for granted in a way. And many of them sound a lot like bugs. And there's a handful of musicians who specifically take sounds of different insects and cut and paste them together. But there's much more music that just sounds like bugs. And that's because I think we just like these kinds of noises. We're sort of ambivalent to noise. On the one hand, we don't like it when there's somebody jackhammering outside the window, or airplanes are always going overhead. But on the other hand, we take our musical instruments, plug them into fuzzy amplifiers, make them sound noisier, because we crave that complexity in tone that's also the same as noise. It's sort of a paradox there.
There were actually efforts to use the sounds of bugs themselves to stop infestations.
Well, this is this famous story of David Dunn, who's a composer, who got intrigued by the idea, by the fact, who wouldn't be disturbed by the fact that hundreds of thousands of acres of western forests are being eaten by these tiny beetles called pine bark beetles. Hundreds of thousands of acres destroyed by these bugs that are like a millimeter in length. It's crazy. And never have we had as big infestations as now, probably because the temperature is getting warmer and they don't die as much over the winter. But we don't really know. But David Dunn has always been a musician who listens in odd places. He stuck microphones down in ponds. He listening underwater. And then he figured out how to turn a meat thermometer into a microphone, stuck it into the trunk of a tree that was full of pine beetles. And not only did he hear them munching and crumbling and away, he heard them communicating. They were like talking to each other in weird little sounds. And then he started thinking, nobody even knew they made sounds. No one bothered to listen like this. And he said, let's start playing sounds to them and see what it does. And he found you could play certain sounds to them and make them go crazy and start eating each other. And he started wondering, maybe sound can help control this problem, this infestation. Of course, to actually do that would be extremely difficult, because you'd need to broadcast sound into each tree. You have hundreds of thousands and millions of trees. So it's not immediately practical, but nevertheless, it's amazing that such a phenomenon is going on. Nobody noticed it before because they didn't take the time to listen. And that's also a big theme in my book throughout, is that, people, once you decide to listen more carefully to the world, you can figure out amazing things. It's only because John Cooley and Dave Marshall started to listen to the cicadas that they heard that females were flicking their wings and making a secondary sound that no one had ever heard before. People have been watching these cicadas for 100, 150 years. But if you listen more closely, you start to hear things that are important to understanding their behavior. And so with the pine beetle story, you know, I asked some scientists, like, what do you think of David Dunn's work? They say, well, it's not really science, because he's just sort of trying things out without sort of rigorously testing it the way science needs to. But until he listened to what's going on inside the tree, no scientist even had any idea that pine beetles made sound. Now that they do, there's all kinds of more serious, slow-moving, meticulous, statistical, quantitative science going on this topic. However, nobody's published anything about it. Because I kept asking them, what do you know? What do you know? They said, nothing. It's taking too long. But, you know, this is an example where a musician came up with something that turned out to be very useful for scientists. And he knows that what he's doing isn't quite science. But he knows now he's helped scientists figure out something they didn't even know was there before he dared to listen where no one had listened before.
Music doesn't have to be productive necessarily. That, you know, this might have been, but you've collected a bunch of bug music that you mentioned earlier. Can you tell us a bit about that?
About the CD, you mean? Mm. That, yes, I mean, what I, in all my projects with birds and with whales and now with insects, a big part of it is me making music together with these sounds. On the one hand, using the sounds in the studio, cutting them together, changing them, working with them to make recorded music, but secondarily performing and playing live with birds and with whales and now with bugs to really interact with them in a domain where I have no idea what's going to happen, where there's this uncertainty, where your music is being made between one species and another. I just think that's interesting and surprising and cool. And some people will say, look, then you're making music no one will like. It's in between one species and another. Who's it for? I said, well, human life is only expanded and enhanced when we take something more seriously that's beyond the limits of our species. It's only a good thing if we start to hear music in the sounds of other creatures that previously we didn't take seriously. So the music is an important part of this whole project for me. The book is incomplete without also listening to the music. And you know, some of these pieces are direct encounters between me and insects, like the first piece. You know, I'm playing live with millions of cicadas around, making this thrumming, droning sound. That one has me playing clarinet. Also, my son, who was 13 years old at the time, is playing an iPad with the cicadas. You know, I think it's maybe what iPads are really good for is making music with bugs, because they make a lot of weird sounds. There's a lot of music programs for them that are very strange. But you can easily make some sounds that cicadas will love, and they'll fly right on your iPad when they hear these sounds that relate to their world of sound. And in another piece, I bring an overtone singer, a guy that can sing several notes at once, named Timothy Hill. He's singing like, and he's making whole chords with his voice. And we're out in the middle of the night with thousands of singing crickets and katydids, and his sound is blurring in with that. But then some other pieces, you know, are kind of electronically made, but emulating an idea from bug music that's just too amazing to ignore, like the sound of the lesser water boatman, a tiny underwater beetle that makes a sound of 80, 90 decibels in volume, nearly as loud as a whale or a rock concert or a subway train. And he does this by waving his penis underwater rapidly back and forth. Shocking, the sound that comes out, and shocking to the scientists who listened underwater, stuck a microphone underwater, a hydrophone they're called, and they heard something so loud and menacing they were sure something was wrong with their equipment. Then they realized this really tiny bug was making the noise. They couldn't believe it. Like, nobody thought a water beetle could be that loud. We knew they made sounds, but not sounds like that. And so, the piece that, you know, that's called The Water Boatman's Loudest Penis on the record, that piece is actually all electronically made, but sort of emulating the sounds of these bugs, which in their actual sonic state are really like little electronic sound generators or synthesizers, you know. You know, the creature is just has like an oscillator in its brain that's telling it to make this sound, so.
In your efforts to have bug music taken more seriously, where are you going? Where's next?
Next, I am going to do more performances of all these creatures and sounds together. And I'm also really trying to work together with scientists to get them to take the musical aspects of animal communication more seriously. And this means really trying to publish some papers and come up with some research that takes this musical phenomenon more seriously as data that can be analyzed in a scientific way. And hopefully not by me, because I get sort of bored doing that. It has to be someone who gets it, who realizes that that kind of analysis should be done and what it would mean, you know, and that's what we've been doing together with this group of researchers at Hunter College in New York, in a lab that's run by this scientist, Ofer Chernikovsky. And he's got postdocs and grad students from all over the world, and some of them are working on this musical stuff. And it's nice to see that this idea, which is just a vague one on my part, can lead to like a whole lot of specific research that different people are doing.
David, thanks very much for being here.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with Bug Girl after these messages.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're diving back into neuroscience to learn how common conceptions of the brain stand up to real research. Desiree Schell speaks to neurologist and author Robert Burton about his book, A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, What Neuroscience Can and Cannot Tell Us About Ourselves. And she's joined by neuroradiologist Jeff Anderson to get the scientific perspective on the differences between the brain's right and left hemispheres. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, here with the lovely Bug Girl, a.k.a. Gwen Pearson. Gwen holds a PhD in entomology and runs Get Your Nature Geek On, a small company that specializes in science communication and websites for nature and research centers. She blogged under the pseudonym Bug Girl for many years, since as a teacher and as a state employee, her ability to rant and rave was limited. She also recently agreed to write for Wired Science. Gwen, as always, it's lovely to have you here.
Hello, although it's a little weird to hear my name.
I know. See, so actually, this is the first time that I've been able to use your real name on air, so... Does it feel odd to have your name now be associated with, like, crabs and insect genitalia and such?
Well, I wasn't going to bring that part up.
Sorry.
But that's okay. I should say, absolutely nobody calls me Gwen except my mom. Everybody does call me Bug. So don't feel like, nobody should feel like they have to change anything. But yeah, it's weird, but at the same time, it's kind of nice because I don't have to worry, you know, who's going to out me this time. I don't actually know what is in store for me as a career. I've just made this huge career change in the middle of my life, and just kind of out of the blue, at the same time I was doing that, Wired said, hey, by the way, we'd really love to have you come and join us. So I was all over it.
So what's your beat then? What are you going to be writing about?
Charismatic microfauna. So everybody knows pandas are cute, right? And I will admit I am a sucker for a baby otter. They are really cute. But there are many equally cool and fascinating insects and spiders and arthropods out there that don't get their share of media coverage. And so that's my beat, is the little teeny cool things that make the world work.
Well, when you and I spoke before the show, you mentioned that you had floated some other blog names.
Yeah. Oh, Bugger was not good. Lice Baby.
Oh, I love that.
Nope.
All right.
Everybody Pupates. Yeah. So in general, I think we came out with a good choice.
You can hire this lady, folks. I'm just saying. Bring her to your town. Okay, so what we are actually here to talk about today are the interesting sounds that bugs make with their bodies. So When I contacted you about doing a segment, you suggested talking about crepitation. So what is that?
Well, crepitation and stridulation are closely related. And essentially... stridulation and crepitation are producing sound by rubbing parts of your body together. So if you've ever run in corduroy pants, that basically can produce a stridulating sound because you have two, you know, ribbed parts rubbing together and producing sound. And so for things like grasshoppers, crickets, there's all sorts of insects that have this sort of basic way of making sound where it's basically sort of a comb and a ridge, and a file and a scraper. And so basically if you take your comb and you run your finger down it really quickly, that's pretty much analogous to what a cricket is doing or a grasshopper is doing. And so it makes this really wonderful sound, and they just do it a lot faster than we can possibly do with our finger on the comb. And so it comes out a different high pitch. So most insects, I mean, it's great that insects sing, and they mostly sing through this mechanism. There's actually also spiders that will stridulate and produce sound. So there's this incredible range of different animals that use this. And for most insects, they're doing this because they're trying to make a hookup. They're little tiny animals, and so they don't work the way that humans do. We're primarily visual. And we don't have great hearing. A lot of the sounds that insects make are out of our range of hearing. And so there's actually a lot of sound out there that we don't hear. And so the insects basically are singing their song, they're trying to attract a mate, or they're trying to defend a territory. You know, this is my spot, you get your own spot. So they're spending a lot of energy into producing these sounds that are very species-specific and help them find a mate.
So now I've noticed you have brought some examples with you today, and I before we get to those, I've noticed that they are genitally oriented. So is all stridulation genitally oriented, or is that just sort of your personal focus? And I wish I had a different way to say that.
Well, I thought it would be, since you're talking to someone else about the more conventional forms of stridulation, you know, cricket singing and katydid singing, that it would be fun to talk about what's called genital stridulation, which is essentially kind of like penis fiddling, where basically
I want that on a t-shirt. Can we just say that? Okay. Sorry. Do continue.
Ask me about my penis fiddle. So essentially, it's the same structure, it's the same mechanism that you have with grasshoppers and crickets, where for crickets, it's two wing surfaces. For grasshoppers, it might be a leg and a wing. Well, you can also, if you, for example, happen to be a water boatman, rub your penis against your stomach, which is ribbed, and it's kind of like a little, I don't know, I guess you could think of it like a penile whammy board, maybe. And so you're rubbing your little whammy bar there and making a great sound. The really interesting thing, if you would like, I can play you a recording.
I would love that.
Okay, so here is a water boatman singing his song with his penis fiddle. And he won't stop singing. There we go.
Okay, so that's a penis.
That's a penis, and it gets better. So you heard that sound. How big do you think that bug is?
I had never thought of that before. I have no idea.
The bug, not the penis.
Right.
We'll get to that.
Oh, sorry. Right. Focus.
So the entire insect that is singing that little song with his penis is 2 millimeters long.
Okay, so do we have superpowered microphones up to a tank?
No, they are that loud. The average song that they sing with their penis is between 90 and 105 decibels.
Okay, what's that? Compare that to something. What else would be about that?
So me talking to you fairly loudly is about 70 decibels. So a motorcycle or a food processor would be in the 90 to 105 decibel range.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So this is a 2 millimeter bug making a sound with its penis. The penis itself is 50 micrometers long.
I love that you know that. I do.
It's what we do as scientists. We measure things.
So why is it that loud? This is an evolutionary advantage, I assume, of some kind.
Well, the short answer is we have no clue, because this is a relatively new discovery. So there's different answers to the why. There's the answer of why physically, you know, how physically does this tiny, tiny thing make this giant sound? And then there's also what advantage is there evolutionarily to the animal? And for both of those right now, we can really only speculate, although I think there's some pretty good physical evidence in favor of how they got to be so loud. The other thing that's really interesting about the recording I played for you, that's a recording made outside a tank of water where the bug was swimming around. So this is a true bug, a water boatman. And what you need to know for that recording that we made, it was, you know, loud, but you know, not blasting. When sound is transferred from water to air, you lose 95% of the sound.
So if you were underwater?
It would be deafening. It would be deafening. And they often chorus. And so imagine hundreds of these little tiny, tiny little bugs zipping around, all wailing on their wangs, and making this incredible racket. And you can actually hear it. If you're walking by the pond, you can actually hear all of them, which is really unusual. If you think about if you're underwater and you try and yell at somebody that's outside the pool, they aren't going to hear you because so much sound is lost in that transfer from water to air. But on the other hand, these things are making so much noise that there's enough that even when you lose 95% of it, we can still record it. That's pretty noisy.
Highly impressive.
So the argument has been made that because they produce so much noise and they are so tiny, I mean, if you really want to know, that the absolute loudest measurement of any animal, I think, is the blue whale. Let's see, is that right? Sperm whale, wrong whale. Well, sperm whale, it would be the sperm whale, wouldn't it? So sperm whale is 236 decibels, but a sperm whale is freaking huge. And so if you control for body size, and if you realize that essentially decibels is a measurement of sound pressure, the amount of sound pressure generated by this tiny, tiny little insect is orders of magnitude larger, because it's a log scale, than that produced by the whale. So you can make a case that this is the largest animal on Earth. I think it's safe to say it's the loudest penis on Earth, but it could also be the largest animal making a noise with or without an actual penis involved.
This is not a Guinness Book of World Records item, I assume.
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay, so next, we have the hawk's moth.
Hawk moths, yes. Yes, and there's the particular hawk moths that I'm talking about are from Borneo. But pretty much everybody in North America has hawk moths around. Their relatives are the things that get in and eat your tomatoes, the tomato hornworm. It's a type of a hawk moth. And the hawk moths are pretty fascinating because both the males and the females are able to jam sonar by producing ultrasound with their genitals.
Okay, I take back what I said about the last impressive one. So how do they do that?
Well, by producing the fabulously named acoustic emissions. honestly, most of these papers, I felt so bad when I was reading them because the whole time I just felt like a 12-year-old.
You mean how I feel right now?
Yeah, but seriously. Genital stridulation to produce acoustic emissions. Say that with a straight face. I can't do it. This may also reflect my maturity level, though. I'm willing to concede that. So essentially, these are big moths. They're preyed on by bats. And there's a lot of moths, actually. A lot of moths can produce ultrasound noises. However, there's only about 10 or 11 moths that can produce ultrasound with their genitals. And they pretty much do it the same way, which is they have the genitals of insects are incredibly variable. It's actually one of the easiest ways for us to tell species apart because there is so much variation from species to species and sometimes also from just individual to individual. So there really isn't any thing that's easily analogous to the human genital system. Other than eggs and sperm, but after that, it's all over the map. So it's kind of a mess. But typically, there's a really elaborate clasping system where the males grab onto the females. And the females also have usually some mechanism for laying eggs. So there's all of these modified appendages and hairs and plates and other sorts of things there. And those are the things that are usually modified to make that sort of rasp and plate, the sort of ridgy spots that they can rub together. So essentially for the female moths, it's kind of like if you could rub your labia together and produce ultrasound.
I believe that's the most vivid visual I've ever had in my life.
Yes, my goal is for every one of your listeners to have their legs firmly crossed by the end of this. And so for the males, they have these, the spines are really, some of the descriptions are really a little disturbing. But so things like robust pointed seedy projecting from the male's outer gonostylus. There's a lot of fancy names for it's hairy, and there's a lot of pointy stuff, and they rub it together, and it makes noise. Although it's many of these papers, I'm not entirely sure I can even read some of them to you because they're just so, you know.
Yes. the thing that you are trying to grope for right now, yes. By any chance, do you have an audio file of this?
I do.
I love you.
The neat thing about these moths is that they're big enough you can actually see this happening. So you can actually see these two plates sort of rubbing together and producing that sound. So yeah, I mean, it's there's the assortment of different moths and flies and true bugs that do this are actually pretty surprising. There's a lot of animals that produce sound, and it turns out that apparently an awful lot of insects have, for whatever reason, specialized in producing sound with their genitals.
I swear I've run out of words. Like, here, my entire brain is like, I'm 14.
Sorry, we
are editing this out. We are absolutely editing this.
No, I think you need to leave that part in. I'm 14. That totally needs to stay in.
Oh, God. I'm fine.
I mean, honestly, some of this behavior by male genitalia that could stimulate the female mainly involves rhythmic thrusting or squeezing. That's straight out of a paper.
So, because when you and I had spoke before the show, I was talking about how there seems to be a lot of penises that make these sounds, but and there was an absence of lady insects making genital noises. And I do realize I've gone to a terribly bad place by mentioning that, but
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. Although the hawk moths that we were just talking about do actually, both the males and females, produce ultrasound. I think it's really mostly a factor of internal versus external genitalia, but also communication mode. So it's fairly common for females to communicate chemically using pheromones, typically, which is a really cheap way to communicate. You can just make a few molecules, release them, they'll passively diffuse in the air, and then from that you can help males find you as a tiny animal. Because that's ultimately why all of these animals are singing or flashing or doing whatever they're doing, is they're trying to get two little tiny animals together in space and time so that they can reproduce. It's more common for males to do a more risky behavior like making a noise, because if I'm, say, a grasshopper singing away, that also is a great notification to all of the things that would like to eat me as a tasty grasshopper. Here I am, come and get me. And so it's more common that the males will have a more showy display, or a display that's a little more risky. And the females will typically be a little bit more subtle and take fewer risks. That's, you know, on average. The other part of it is that because these males have plates, if you want some entomological trivia, so earwigs have two penises, and one of them is basically a stunt penis in case the first one breaks. There's opportunities there if you have all of these appendages and strange modifications, then the opportunity to turn one of them into essentially your, you know, a fiddle, it's a lot easier than if you have everything inside and it's all squishy, more like a female moth.
I love your use of technical terms.
Squishy, yes. That's a very important scientific word.
And I can't think of anywhere better to end the show. So, Gwen, Bug Girl, whatever, you are wonderful, and do come back soon.
I never did get to say it's ribbed for her pleasure, though.
All right. There will be a link to Gwen Pearson on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, do click the link to Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and iTunes, fulfilling all of your Skeptically Speaking-related needs. We'll close the show with one of the songs from David Rothenberg's CD, Bug Music, Katie Did Prehistory. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. Thank you.
Thank you.